This is Fresh Air. I'm Jerry Gross. Al Franken has spent much of his adult life working on Saturday Night Live as a writer, performer, and producer. But he recently left the show, so his latest political satires are in a new book. It's called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. Some of those other observations have to do with Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. Here's Franken reading the chapter, The Newt Cancer Surgery Story, What the Liberal Media Might Not Be Telling You.
You've probably heard the famous story about Newt Gingrich and his first wife, Jackie, the one in which he visited her in a hospital when she was recovering from cancer surgery. As the story goes, Gingrich brought along their two daughters and a yellow legal pad with his terms for a divorce, which he read to her while she was still groggy. Now, one thing you should know about the story is this. It's true. Gingrich has acknowledged all but the groggy part, telling Time magazine that the story was a bit of a caricature. And to be fair, there is no way to know what goes on between two people. Anyone who's been married knows that. In fact, I think the liberal media's portrayal of this whole ugly episode has been a little unfair to Newt. Maybe if we knew the real story, Newt wouldn't come out looking like such a pig. Maybe it went like this. Jackie calls Newt at home just before she goes into surgery. Newt, I'm more certain than ever that I want a divorce. But honey, you're about to undergo cancer surgery. You don't know what you're saying. Newt, please. When you bring the girls today, I also want you to bring a legal pad with terms for a divorce. For God's sakes, you're having cancer surgery. Would you stop it, Newt? This is what I want. What I don't want is for you to blame yourself. You're too good a person for that. It could have been like that, and to assume otherwise would be unfair. Of course, what we do know is that after the divorce, he was late with his alimony payments, and she had to take him to court twice to provide adequate support for her and the girls, and that her church took up a collection to help them get by. That we do know.
Al Franken, that's an excerpt of your new book, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between writing a book of political satire, your first book of that sort, and doing a political sketch for Saturday Night Live?
Well, I was very frightened when I started this book because I didn't know if I could write in a voice,
mm-hmm.
you know. And when you do a sketch, what really drives sketch comedy are the characters. So at Saturday Night Live, we were fortunate to have people like Dana Carvey could do Bush and Chevy did Ford and Dan Aykroyd could do, did Nixon and Carter. So it was really around that performance. And this was very frightening to me because I had to find out if I had a voice to write in, and I think I succeeded.
Why did you give your book the title that you did? Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. Why Rush Limbaugh in the title?
Well, first of all, he is really fat. But why Rush? He really was, he was called the majority maker by the freshman members of Congress and was made an honorary member of the class of 94. So I sort of felt that I could use his views as a way of explaining the Republican Revolution. And he's become a mouthpiece, really, for the freshmen and for the Gingrich wing of the party. So I thought it might sell some books.
More importantly, right?
Yeah. So as soon as I thought of the title, Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations, and then that was the first thing I did on this book, and then I took a month off. Because I said, hey, I got a good title. and my publisher really liked the title, but my editor called back after thinking about it a week. She said, legal says, you might have to change the title. We might not be able to use that. And I said, well, he's a public figure. She goes, well, yeah, but they say you really have to write about Rush Limbaugh then. And I go, well, that's my intention. So the book is, I sort of use Rush as a way of explaining, this new Republican Congress and also some of the presidential candidates. I go into a lot of different things, but Rush is throughout the book.
When did you first start listening to Rush Limbaugh and how did you start?
Well, I think I heard him first in a cab in New York. And the first time I ever heard him on the radio, he was ranting about feminazis and how feminists believe that all heterosexual sex is rape, and which I admit is a very hard viewpoint to defend. The thing is, though, know a lot of women, all of whom consider themselves feminists, and only one holds this view, and we've been married nearly 20 years.
Right.
So that's the first time I listened. And then I started tuning him in every once in a while, and then I started watching his show. And I was just amazed at sort of the disinformation that he was putting out.
Yes, you've actually concluded that part of the point of his show is to punish you for actually knowing anything.
Yes.
How did you reach that conclusion?
Well, the first time I saw his TV show, I write about this in the book, it was the day after President Bush, this is like in October of 92, Bush had appeared on Larry King and said some things about Clinton organizing protests in Great Britain during the war and saying, I don't know, you know, it makes me uncomfortable organizing demonstrations while, you know, your countrymen are dying in another country. I just don't like it. It just doesn't sit well with me. So the next day, the New York Times ran a headline saying Bush questions Clinton's patriotism. And so Rush is on the next night, and he holds up this headline and goes, like, I listened to this interview, and he never questioned his patriotism. Here, let's watch. And then he shows a clip from the Larry King interview, a 20-second clip from a totally different part of the interview. And then we'll be right back. And he says, did you hear one question of Clinton's brave patriotism? This is a typical example of the liberal media and how they bend the truth. And the only way you're going to get the truth is from me. And then we'll be right back. And then cut to his, you know, audience of right-wing geeks applauding madly. And what's interesting about him and his listeners who proudly call themselves ditto heads because they agree with everything he says. There was this study done at the Annenberg School on people on how they get their news. And this was done during the healthcare debate. And they asked people get their news either from, you know, news primarily from newspapers or from TV news, or there were some people, a group of people who got their news primarily from talk radio, and those people primarily got it from Rush Limbaugh. So they asked all these different people, all these groups, how well informed they felt they were, they thought they were. And the people who got their news from talk radio and primarily from Rush rated themselves as the best informed. Then they tested the people objectively on how well they were informed by asking them questions of fact about the healthcare debate. And the Limbaugh listeners were the least informed, objectively. So I asked the person who ran this study, I said, well, how is this possible that the people who consider themselves the most informed are actually the least informed? And she said, well, a social scientist calls it pseudo-certainty. And, you know, I call it being a cretin, is what I call it. But anyway, so what he does is he lies a lot. I was going to call the book Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Liar and Other Observations, but that just seems so confrontational. And he misleads a lot by omitting very, very important things.
When you look at Rush Limbaugh, does he, let me put it this way, you know how sometimes you look at somebody and you feel like you knew them when you were in grade school or high school, or mm-hmm. you knew somebody just like them? Do you ever feel that way looking at Rush Limbaugh? And if so, does he remind you of a particular person?
I don't think so. I mean, he reminds you of a type of person. You know, I say Rush attacks women a lot. You know, he says that feminism was created so that ugly women could take a place in the mainstream of society. And he, you know, has been criticized for that and keeps defending having said that. He actually said that and means it. And I was trying to figure out why he gets away with this. And I sort of think that he gets away with attacking women because he's obviously such a sort of a sad, fat, pathetic loser who's had such a tough time with women that people kind of feel sorry for him. And, you know, he's been married 3 times and met his third wife on the internet. I'm taunting him. Come on, Rush.
Do you want Rush Limbaugh to engage you in public debate?
If he had a milliliter of testosterone in his body, he'd come after me. No, we sent him a book.
No, you know what he'd say?
What?
You're not important enough.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good. I sent him a book. My publisher sent him a letter, which I dictated, which was, "Dear Rush, Al feels it would help sales if you mentioned the book on your show."
That's good.
Yeah. We haven't heard from him.
You do a lot of political humor, and specific people are often targets of your humor. So you have to deal a lot with questions of taste. What's tasteful? What's tasteless? What's too mean to say?
Mm-hmm. Well, I call this book Mean But Uncompromisingly Fair.
Translated?
Well, you know, what I did was I sort of, part of this is about, is a satire on the breakdown in the civility of public discourse. And I sort of do it by using the methods that Limbaugh and Gingrich and GOPAC, which was Gingrich's political action committee, used. They're in a letter to their candidates, the Republican candidates, Gingrich offered this advice: go negative early, use small details to demonize your opponents, and never try to educate. Which is really odd, because he always talks about being a teacher. So that's, I sort of am trying to hold them accountable for their techniques and their methods and be funny about it.
My guest is Al Franken. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with political satirist Al Franken. His new book is called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. Al Franken, you have to deal with questions of taste all the time. And
yes.
Sometimes I'd imagine right before going on, you're even thinking in your mind, should I do this joke or not? In fact, I know that happened one time because you write about it in your book at a White House correspondents' dinner where, you know, the president and the first lady and the vice president are all in the audience. And you're deciding what joke to lead off with and whether it's going to be too tasteless or not. This was the day after Nixon's death. What was the joke you were thinking of telling and weren't sure about?
Well, Nixon had died the night before. And I was just in my mind going, do I tell a joke about this? And I have some friends who are Washington friends. And Jonathan Alter from Newsweek said, oh, yeah, you got to do a Nixon joke. Everyone's going to be expecting you to do something. And I went to Norm Ornstein, who's with the American Enterprise Institute, and he said, you'd be insane to do a Nixon joke. So during dinner, I spoke after dinner. I'm going, what should I do? And the joke I was going to do was, you know, I was feeling pretty good yesterday because I had 10 minutes of dynamite Nixon material. But that was a joke I didn't tell. I decided not to do. There was also a joke that I didn't tell about the vice president, which was, before the dinner, there's a cocktail party for the people on the dais, which include the president and the first lady and the vice president and Tipper. So I had this joke about the vice president. And I went up to Tipper, and I was really worried about it because I didn't want to cross the line. So I went up to Tipper, and I said, I have this joke about your husband, and my instinct tells me not to tell it, that it's over the line. She said, well, what's the joke? I said, okay, well, here's the joke. Vice President Gore continued to show his commitment to the environment by announcing today that he's going to change the policy on the stick up his butt. Instead of replacing the stick every day with a new stick, the vice president will keep the same stick up his butt for the rest of the administration.
What was Tipper's reaction to this?
Well, she looked at me, just kind of looked at me and just said, like I was crazy, and said, I would go with your instinct.
So you didn't tell it?
I didn't tell the joke.
So what did you open with?
I opened with this joke, which it's a tremendous honor to be asked to speak here at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, to speak before the president, the first lady, the vice president, Mrs. Gore, Wolf Blitzer. I got a nice laugh, proving my theory that Wolf Blitzer is a funny name.
Now, you write in your book that you got Ron Nessen, former White House press secretary, to host Saturday Night Live while President Ford was in office.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out just being a disaster for Ford.
Right.
What were some of the worst moments from Ford's perspective?
Well, this was the kind of thing where Nessen came in, and we sort of expected him to be very concerned about what we were doing, and he didn't seem concerned at all. So we had, let me find in the book, because this is a list of stuff You mind if I do that?
No.
Well, how can you mind? Let's see. Well, you know, in the book, I do these sort of, as you know, I do these adventures in politics, which are sort of, you know, my experiences in politics. And this is one of them, is getting... Okay, oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there was an Oval Office sketch in which Nesson appeared playing himself, and Chevy Chase played Ford, doing things like stapling his ear and kicking a wastebasket and saying "Heel Liberty" to a stuffed dog. There were sketches which Nesson didn't appear in which there's one which Chevy and Jane Curtin were writhing under sheets in their bedroom as robed Supreme Court justices made sure that they weren't doing anything too kinky. There's an Emily Letella sketch that Gilda did, or piece that she did about presidential erections. And then there was this hilarious parody of the, with a name like Smuckers, It Has to Be Good commercial written by Michael O'Donohue, and it had names for jams like Nose Hair, Death Camp, Mangled Baby Ducks, Dog Vomit, Monkey Pus, and Painful Rectal Itch. And the greatest part about this is that Nesson had convinced the president to open the show with a live from New York on Saturday night. So it was kind of his, like, presidential endorsement of our show. Oh, yeah, and I forgot there was the Autumn Fizz parody, which Gilda pitched a carbonated douche. So the White House staffers were not, and the president were not pleased.
Well, what was the moral of the story for you at Saturday Night Live? That you should do this again or never do this again?
Well, you know, at SNL, we had, you know, I'm not there anymore, but they still have the policy, which is a host, you want to try to make the host look good. And a host, we never, ever force a host to do anything he or she doesn't want to do. And it's that's only because you want the host to look good because you want to get hosts. You don't want people not to want to do the show. So all it really taught me was basically that Nesson didn't have his, was not really looking out, you know, for the president, I don't think, there. Maybe he was just trying to be a good sport or something like that. So I didn't really learn a lesson at all. Now that I think about it, it was just, you know, if I ever in that situation, you know, if you visit a show, you have to take care of yourself, but you also have to trust people. So it's a delicate balance.
You know, we've talked a little about what it's been like for you to consider telling a joke to the wrong audience or a joke at the wrong time. You've also been in the position of being misinterpreted when you've said something, and you talk about that a little bit in your book. I'll tell a story of what you said at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government when you were talking to students there and did a Q&A session with them after your talk.
Yeah, I went to, a couple years ago, I was invited to go to the JFK School, and there was this huge crowd, standing room only, and the day before, or I think it was a couple days before, the speaker had been the editor of the only opposition newspaper in El Salvador, and six people came to his thing. And mine was standing room only because I'd worked with John Belushi. So, you know, the show has always been considered something of a white male bastion. You know, except for maybe the Eddie Murphy years. So somebody in the question and answers got up and said, why don't you hire more minorities? And I said, well, you know, we have, you know, two very funny people, Tim Meadows and Ellen Cleghorn, our cast members, and Rob Schneider is half Jewish and half Filipino, if that's any help, you know. And this person wouldn't stop and kept badgering me about this. And finally, I just said, well, also, one reason is that minorities just aren't funny. And there's like 500 people there or 300 people, whatever it was. And they all laugh. Even the guy asking the question laugh. So the next day in the Harvard Crimson, it's reported that Al Franken at this thing said that minorities just aren't funny. And it was sort of like, you know, I know how... Irony, this is why I can never be a politician, because irony looks really bad in print and cold type.
Al Franken, his new book of political satire is called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations. This is Fresh Air.